occupational hazard in philosophy, that by the time you've got to the end of figuring out what you think about some topic that initially seemed puzzling and interesting, everything that you're saying comes across to you, at any rate, as being either trivial or false. In my case, I think that everything I'm going to say today is trivial. So I'm relying on you to raise objections. I'd rather this be a discussion than me just talking at you. So please do interrupt as we go along. However, despite the fact that I think it's trivial, it does imply that lots of the very intuitive-sounding things that David was saying yesterday are false. So maybe it's interesting anyway. Okay, so I want to talk about the many worlds interpretation, and the overarching thesis of what I'm going to say is that there aren't any reasons arising from conceptual worries about the notion of probability for rejecting a many worlds interpretation. So we have this theory. The motivation for being a many worlds theorist is you start out with textbook quantum mechanics, you notice that it has a measurement problem, you want to be a realist, so you don't want anything like Copenhagen. You have worries about alternative solutions to the measurement problem, like hidden variable theories and GRW-style spontaneous collapse theories, and the many worlds interpretation seems to be the only thing that's left on the table. So that's the original motivation. And then what we want to know is, can we just take that motivation, become many worlds theorists, and have no further difficulties showing us that we couldn't go that route after all? Here's roughly the shape of the program. You start with this thing, psi. This is the wave function of the universe. According to the many worlds theory, at the level of fundamental ontology, that's all there is. It's important to realize this because this wasn't true in early versions of the many worlds theory, and I think that the approach becomes vastly more plausible once we realize that it's very parsimonious at the level of fundamental ontology. In particular, there aren't any worlds yet at this level. Yeah.
Is there a Hilbert space and an algebra of observables on it?
Yes.
And excuse me, psi is a time dependent, is it Schrodinger state or a Heisenberg state?
I don't think it matters. It's going to pan out slightly differently depending on whether you're in a non-relativistic quantum mechanics case or whether you're going to be ever acting by quantum gravity.
I'm just asking whether psi depends on time.
And I'm saying it's going to pan out differently in different cases, and I don't think it's going to matter.
I
think non-relativistic and say it depends on time if you want. That's fine.
Okay.
Okay, so how do we start talking about worlds? The idea is, this is all there is fundamentally, but we also want to relate what our theory postulates there is fundamentally to our everyday macroscopic experience. So we want to know how to relate statements about what people and tables and chairs are doing to this fundamental quantum state of the universe. And the idea is that in order to do this, you don't just look at psi. You first decompose it into a decoherent history set. And having done that, the thought is, you're going to end up with something like a branching structure. So at any rate, in the non-relativistic case, what's going on is that at early times, you have lots of histories sharing projectors with one another, and then at later times, you have different things going on in different histories. That's what's underpinning these branching trees that many world theorists always draw.
Could I ask a question? So isn't there another hidden assumption that creeps in here, which is that the wave function has the property that it contains decoherent histories? Because as Jim Harvey has argued, the vast majority of them don't.
So it better contain decoherent history.
Right.
Well, there's always some decoherent set, but it's not necessarily, doesn't have anything to do with us. So.
Right, well, it better be the case that it contains a quasi-classical set, otherwise the theory won't be empirically adequate. It won't support anything like what we see.
Right, so the psi isn't the only thing there is. We've got psi plus a postulate that it has.
Well, the postulate isn't supposed to be part of physical reality. Psi is supposed to be the thing that represents physical reality, and then psi is supposed to have certain properties like the one that Edith mentioned. Okay. So let's suppose that we get this far. Thus far, we're happy that the many worlds theorists will get here and identify the appropriate quasi-classical history set. Then there's supposed to be a problem, which David was explaining very clearly yesterday, about how one is supposed to understand probabilities if one's a many worlds theorist. And very roughly, the problem is just this. If you're a many worlds theorist and you're about to perform a measurement, say it's a spin measurement, and it's the sort of measurement that you normally describe as having two possible outcomes with non-zero probabilities, spin up and spin down. And you can normally say things like, according to quantum mechanics, the probability of spin up is 2/3. And the main world theory is supposed to be a theory that's empirically equivalent to quantum mechanics. So if the normal predictions of quantum mechanics makes it probabilistic, it had better be the case, one might think, that the predictions of the many worlds theory makes it probabilistic. And the worry is, it can't do that. And the reason for thinking it can't do that is that if we're here before the measurement, there doesn't seem to be anything for non-trivial probabilities, probabilities other than zero or one, to be probabilities of. They can't, for example, at least at first sight, be the probability that spin up will happen, because the many worlds theorist thinks with degree of belief one that spin up will happen on some branch, also that spin down will happen on some branch. Okay. So.
But sorry, isn't the whole idea that you have more branches with spin up twice as many as you do with spin down? And then the difficulty is, how do you count branches? Or which basis do you use?
Right. So, when I was at a PI about 18 months ago, and I was trying to convince someone for the sake of argument that there was a problem with probability in the many worlds interpretation, even though I think there isn't, I was trying to say, here's the prima facie problem, said roughly what I just said. And the guy said, I don't see the difficulty, why don't you just say spin up happens on 2/3 of the branches? And I said, well, that's not going to work, because that means you still don't have a theory that's empirically equivalent to normal quantum mechanics, blah, blah, blah. In fact, at the end of the day, I think that's exactly the right response. And I think it does render the many worlds theory perfectly adequate. But I think there are some rather non-trivial moves we need to make before we can really see that that is good enough. So I think at the end of the talk, I'm going to end up agreeing with you. But I think it's slightly less trivial.
Would there be an issue about, it's fine with 2/3, but take, you know, an arbitrary real number to divide them up, then already each branching becomes an uncountably infinite number.
So it's important that...
It's the whole measure.
Yeah, the quantum theory gives us a measure on the set of branches by the Born law.
Right, that's yet another rule that must be important. The Born rule doesn't come out of the theory.
That's a question I'm going to be agnostic about. Some people think that it does in the Everettian case. Right. Others think that it doesn't.
I've heard that claim.
Yeah. So in the non-many worlds case, we don't normally think we're able to derive the Born rule. We normally postulate it. If we're just trying to argue, which is all I'm trying to do today, that the many worlds theorist is no worse off than a non-many worlds theorist, vis-a-vis the notion of probability, there's going to be okay to postulate the Born rule. Some Everettians, notably David Deutsch and David Wallace, have claimed that in fact the many worlds theory is much better off than everybody else, vis-a-vis probability, because the Everettian can, while nobody else can, derive the Born rule. But that's not a claim that I'm going to be talking about.
Right.
That's a little unfair, though, to say that in the non-many worlds case, the Born rule isn't derivable, or it's normally thought, because I think there's a lot of branches of quantum foundations where they think that the Born rule has been derived. So take Gleason's theorem, for instance.
Sure.
This is touted as a derivation of the Born rule. Think of Lucien Hardy's operational version of quantum mechanics. He thinks he has derived the Born rule. He thinks he has.
Right. I don't think there are any other derivations of the Born rule from a realist point of view.
There you go. Okay.
And if you don't want to be a realist, you know,
so
you wouldn't have got this far in the talk anyway.
So what are your reasons for not buying the relative frequency argument?
Okay. So the relative frequency argument is the observation that if you perform repeated trials of the same experiment, and in the limit, as the number of trials goes to infinity, the amplitude squared measure of the branches on which the relative frequency matches the psi squared measure goes to 1, right? That's the argument you have in mind.
Yes.
This has precisely the same logical shape as the usual frequentist observations in the non-many worlds context,
yeah,
that relative frequency matches the single case chance in the limit as the number of trials goes to 1. That can't be a definition of the notion of probability, because it will be circular as a definition. You only get relative frequencies matching single case chances in that limit with probability 1. if he started out thinking, I'm not willing to regard this measure over branches as anything like a probability, I don't see any reason to care about this measure. Then you get to the point where you said, well, the relative frequency turns out right on measure one of these branches according to some measure that I don't care about. And that doesn't seem to get you anywhere.
So I thought the result was that you construct an operator which, by construction, has eigenvalues which are relative frequencies. Mm-hmm. And you show that in the limit of an infinite number of trials, the state is an eigenstate of that operator. And so you define the notion of relative frequency through the construction of the operator. Am I correct that the only issue is the same everyday issue of going from a finite number of trials, which we really do in real life, to definitions which involve infinite quantities. So it's no different than the arguments we make in statistical mechanics about phase transitions or about second law or things like that.
Right. I'm worried by the finite number of trials versus infinite number of trials issue.
But supposing I have a naive view, sort of for all practical purposes view about that kind of infinity. So I'm willing, I'm naive and I'm willing to take for all practical purposes a result about an infinite limit and apply it to very large cases. So I know that there is serious worry by by people who worry about the meaning of probability about that move.
Right.
But if I'm willing to make that move because I'm dumb and naive, then
I think you're fine.
Then I'm fine.
But I'm not willing to make that move because it seems that there's a crucial conceptual difference in this case between the finite and the infinite number of cases. Namely, after any finite number of runs, there are still non-zero components of the wave function where the described branches with anomalous statistics. And that's not the case in the infinite number of trials. So after an infinite number of trials, you can just say, on every branch, the relative frequency will match the single case amplitude squared.
Right. Okay.
And then it seems that everything's okay, but you can't say that until you get to the infinite limit. You don't get any closer to it as you get closer to the infinite limit.
So is another version of this argument, supposing that we do some experiments and we see results, probabilistic results, that come out differently than the predictions of quantum mechanics, that doesn't refute quantum mechanics on the many worlds formulation because there definitely are branches in which that happens.
Yeah, good. That's another version of it. You're getting way ahead of me.
Oh, yes. Right.
Good. Okay. So there are supposed to be these sorts of worries with the notion of probability in the Everett interpretation. I was going to briefly discuss three previous attempts to solve the problem, which I don't think are adequate. The first was this appeal to relative frequencies, which was discussed, among other people, by Everett in his original 1957 work, by DeWitt in 73, and also by Jim Hartle in 68.
68, mm-hmm. But not in the Everett context.
Mm-hmm. Arguably. Okay, so that's one. And I've just said why I'm not happy with that one. The second attempt was by David Deutsch in 85. So Deutsch said, motivated in part by the preferred basis issue, how do you know with respect to which basis you're supposed to decompose the wave function in order to get the branches? That was part of his motivation. But another part was, how do we make sense of probabilities? What these considerations motivated Deutsch to do was to say, okay, let's give up on the original Everettian project. The wave function isn't everything. We're going to add, at the level of fundamental ontology, in addition to the wave function, a continuous infinity of worlds, and these worlds are not primitive, they're not emergent. Then what we can do is the following. Suppose you have a situation where the amplitude squared of the branches work out like this, 2/3 versus 1/3. Then you can say, okay, I have this continuous infinity of worlds all along following this branch. That continuous infinity of worlds is equipped with a preferred measure. And what happens when you get a branching event, when the worlds diverge, is that according to this preferred measure, 2/3 of the worlds go this way, and 1/3 of the worlds go that way. Then you can say, okay, now I know how to make sense of probabilities in the many worlds theory, even before a measurement, because that can just be a measure of my ignorance about which of these worlds I'm in. If my ignorance matches the natural measure, then I'll say the degree of belief that I'm going to end up on the split-up branch is two-thirds, and that seems fine. Yeah.
You slipped in the word emergence there, rather craftily.
it wasn't supposed to be crafty.
So, are you using that in the sense of the philosopher's sense of the word emergence?
Roughly, but not in a loaded sense. I just mean, so there's supposed to be this distinction between what you have to postulate at the fundamental level and stuff that's supposed to arise from that. Right. So, for example, in the context of classical physics, I would think that if I tell you the positions and velocities of all the particles in the universe,
right.
everything else will emerge in some relatively innocuous sense from that. So that's all I mean.
But sometimes it's not innocuous.
Right.
And so, but you think here it is.
I want the innocuous version.
So you're introducing a measure that you're not actually trying to count in the Drew world.
That's right.
Just as a technique, what are all those lines? Are they Feynman paths or something like that?
The Deutsch worlds.
But what is the Deutsch world? I mean,
well, it's something like the thing that we live in. There's a continuous infinity of them, and they always track deep in their history.
So he doesn't have branching, he just has differentiation of worlds.
Yeah.
So they start out all the same, and then they differentiate in that ratio.
How are they represented in the theory? By projection operators?
No, they're just something that you stick in after you've done all the maths to make sense of probability. I'm not saying it's a good theory. I'm saying these are the sort of lengths that people were driven to at some time to try and solve the problem of probability in the many worlds theory.
But there's also no correspondence with the formulas.
Say again, sorry?
There's no correspondence with there's no way of interpreting what those lines
are. Well, you get the... there's no way of interpreting the lines themselves. You get the measure by the formula. It's
at the time he introduced the interpretation basis, so there was a fixed basis.
Right.
So it there was one fixed basis at the outset.
Yes.
And that stayed.
But
that
he didn't
stayed
precisely there. Define it in terms of a theory.
Yeah.
Because it can't be done.
That's right. But that's the lines. The lines are the weights.
Right. But what Jim is saying is right. You don't define the basis that these lines follow in precise terms in the terms of a theory.
But is this supposed to be the basis? So those are all states? And
say again, sir?
Is it supposed to be a basis? Let's suppose they can't define it, but is their idea that it is, each one of those lines corresponds to a basis?
Yeah, I think the idea would
no,
be...
No, each one of those lines corresponds to a basis element in a basis.
So pick some preferred decoherent history set. Never mind how you manage to prefer it. Just pick it. Then each of the lines represents a history.
Yeah, but they don't all go one way or the other, don't they? Each individually.
No,
right,
no. The whole idea was to get away from the branching, which people thought was introducing some additional dynamics into the theory. You know, how was the universe able to split like this, and what explained that dynamical process? And so, by introducing all keeping the total number of worlds always the same and just allowing them to differentiate, he got around that. I thought it was rather neat.
But I don't get it. I mean, in the usual story, histories are represented by sequences of projections. Mm-hmm. When
Deutsch can still represent them that way.
Pardon?
Deutsch can still represent histories that way. Start with the wave function, find your preferred decoherent history set, represent each history by a string of projections.
Yeah.
And then draw a picture in which each of those strings of projections is represented by a line.
Okay. But, all right.
So that was the idea. And it does get around worrying about probability not making sense. The reason it's a disaster is that it amounts to giving up all the original motivations one had for being a many worlds theorist in the first place. The game was to see whether we could get away with not having hidden variables, not modifying the Schrödinger equation, just having a wave function and unitary evolution, and coming up with a satisfactory theory just on that basis. And what was nice about that sort of theory is that at the level of fundamental ontology, it was very elegant and parsimonious. This isn't elegant or parsimonious. We've added extra fundamental things that can't be precisely defined in terms of a fundamental theory. And that's bad. So this was just a sort of excursion through one previous attempt to solve the problem of probability and why we don't like it. Albert and Loewe in 1988, David mentioned this yesterday as well, they have a variant on this strategy. They draw the same kind of pictures, more or less. Instead of having many worlds, they have many minds. this is an even more desperate attempt to solve the problem of probability. You have to be a dualist in the philosophy of mind. You have to think that mind and body are separate types of stuff, that is. And then you have to say, okay, associated with every sentient observer is a continuous infinity of minds. And here's how I'm going to solve the probability problem. While the dynamics for the physical stuff is deterministic, the minds obey a stochastic dynamics. So what you mean when you say the probability of spin-up is 2/3 is, according to the stochastic dynamics that governs the evolution of my mind, there's a genuine probability of 2/3 that the mind that I now am is going to end up on the spin-up branch. And that's even more of a disaster. You have to believe dualism in the philosophy of mind, and dualism in the philosophy of mind is false. And you have to talk about all these stochastic dynamics governing the evolution of minds that you're not really able to write down. And it's all horrible, so this is even worse. So we want some other resolution of the problem of probability if we have any remaining desire to be many world theorists. Is that a hand? Okay. All right, so now I'm on to point number 2 on the handout. If you didn't have a handout, I left some in the corners. And there's some more here. Okay, so I agree with David that the issue here is really one of theory confirmation. The reason that we want probabilities in the many worlds interpretation is not precisely that we insist on having an interpretation that's empirically equivalent to the usual formulations of quantum mechanics. The problem is rather something like this. We think back to our original empirical reasons for taking anything like Copenhagen quantum mechanics seriously in the first place. And they seem to have roughly the following form. We did a bunch of experiments, we observed some relative frequencies, then we came up with a theory, namely quantum mechanics, which predicted single case chances that roughly matched those observed relative frequencies. And this seems, in a very innocuous and prosaic sort of sense, to count as empirical confirmation of something like the quantum mechanical theory. And while we're talking about genuinely probabilistic theories, as Copenhagen was supposed to be, this seems fairly sensible. The worry is that if, motivated by something like the measurement problem, we decide to become many worlds theorists, we're going to cut off the epistemological branch we were sitting on. What I mean by that is we're going to lose our empirical reason for believing anything like quantum mechanics in the first place. Specifically, the worry is it's not going to make sense once you're a many worlds theorist to say something like, we've observed relative frequencies which approximately match the branch weights postulated by the many worlds theory. By branch weight, I mean the amplitude squared measure that the many worlds theory puts over the set of branches. It seems to make much less sense. It seems to sound much less plausible to say that observing high branch weight events counts as confirmatory of your theory than it does to say that observing high probability events counts as confirmatory of your theory. So, to put that another way, I take it that something like this principle, I've called it CC, confirmation theoretics of chance, confirmation theoretic status of chances. It seems that something like this roughly captures the confirmation theoretic role that chances play. If I have a theory T, and my theory assigns higher chance to some outcome X than any rival theory does, and if I then observe outcome X, then T is confirmed relative to those rival theories. This seems to be a principle that we all accept, and there doesn't seem to be a problem with it.
There's a huge problem with it.
Well, okay, there are subtle problems with it.
No, it's not at all subtle. It's related to David's worry yesterday about probabilities. If I worry about why the parameters in standard model are finely tuned, we can just take a cosmological constant, but there's a whole list of issues about fine-tuning with them. Mm. Let me give you on what we know on sort of both standard theory by physicists. This seems unlikely. Okay, on the deistic strong anthropic principle, it has probability 1. That theory is that God made the universe so that there would be intelligent creatures that would come to know and love Him. Mm. So that's the theory that gives probability 1. It's in competition with other theories that, from the point of view which what's observed is very low probability. Mm. So, and this argument is made by people, like Falkenhorn and so forth. Therefore, on exactly this criteria, we should all be anthropic.
Okay, I was with you up until the last sentence. So I would have thought the right thing to say about that sort of case is, yes, it's true that if your deistic theory assigns probability 1 to such and such parameters, then observing such and such parameters confirms your theory relative to mine. However, there are all sorts of other things that are wrong with your theory. And when we do the full calculation, the balance is going to come out in favor of my theory over yours. So you might worry about there being no explanatory power whatsoever to postulating a deity. You might assign theories like that extremely low prior. That's what I do. Confirm means credence in it gets boosted very, very slightly, but if credence in it started out essentially zero anyway, I'm still not going to end up taking the deistic theory seriously.
It's a long discussion, but it's, people from that perspective are making this argument based on precisely the same principle strongly, and I don't think they will be impressed by what you just said.
Okay.
They will point to the very low probability of explaining what we observe on the basis of non-deistic physics, and make a case that they have a scientific argument for deism.
Okay. I appreciate the force of that point. I do think it falls into the category of points that, relative to the worries that I'm discussing, are subtle. I'm discussing an extremely unsubtle problem with the many worlds theory, which really is just about the common or garden relationship between relative frequencies and theory confirmation, with nothing anthropic going on. Let me try this as a... This is a first pass at what's going on, and we're later going to want to refine it. But the worries with the many worlds theory are going to crop up, I think, even before we get to the level of subtle refinements to knock out arguments like that one that we don't like.
Isn't there something anthropic going on, again, sort of hidden through this? Because we're going to talk about confirming theories and observing branches and so on. And so, by definition, we got into this yesterday, and a subset of these branches will be observed, or directly observed, or so isn't there an anthropic selection? Well, anthropic is the wrong word, of course, but cognitive.
I don't think so, because this problem crops up even in the extremely boring, for want of a better word, situations where there are observers on all the branches. So nobody's going to die. There aren't black holes anywhere in the picture.
It's got some of it. It seems to me that you've got all sorts of decoherent histories, and they won't all be observed.
Right, but let me just describe an extremely simple, idealized case in which, nevertheless, the problem already crops up.
You've just got
two mysteries, a spin-up one and a spin-down one. This one contains a guy looking at an apparatus and saying, my measurement result was spin-up. This one contains a guy looking at an apparatus and saying, my measurement result was spin-down. We don't worry about the fact that there are all these extremely low amplitude branches on which the guy exploded. Never mind that. Idealize those away. We already have a problem.
Right, okay. Are you allowed to use a word like confirmed?
Yes.
It's politically correct.
That's right. I mean, you can tell me I'm not, but I think I'm not.
Well, we had this discussion the other day about falsifiability and the limitations of that. And this.
Quite, but I think the outcome of that discussion is we should be talking about confirmation and disconfirmation rather than falsification.
Right, but I guess the word relative is the key point there. You don't ever confirm any theory. So you only just accumulate evidence that it's a reliable description of the world.
I can confirm it relative to other theories. I can say this one seems to be doing better than anything else I get from
it. Right. I'm not sure confirm.
Maybe supports is another word.
This is a traditional meaning of this word. I might just put another positive sounding adjective in there if you want.
Yeah, don't like confirm. Always leave room for doubt if you're a scientist.
Confirmation makes room for doubt.
Right. Okay.
Okay, so the worry was just, while this sounds relatively reasonable, modulate worries of the type that Lee was raising. This one, at first sight, to most people, sounds crazy. I'm going to be arguing that this one is just as true as that one is. But this is supposed to sound crazy at first sight. If you have a branching universe theory, like the many worlds interpretation of quantum mechanics, and if your theory assigns higher branch weight to some outcome X than do rival theories, although, by the way, it also says that all other outcomes will be realized on some branch or other. Nevertheless, observation of outcome X confirms your theory relative to those rivals. The worry is that this is true, so a collapsed version of quantum mechanics is fine. This is not true, so the many worlds theory is sunk. That's the worry. That's David's objection.
And branch weight is defined how?
It's going to end up being a technical term in decision theory, but let me give you the unsubtle version of the answer first. The unsubtle version is it's the amplitude squared that you get from wave functions. Okay. So I'm of the opinion that the right way to think about confirmation while you're just worrying about these very common or garden issues of the relationship between relative frequency observations and confirmation of chance and theories, is the Bayesian framework. Jim talked about this a little bit the other day, sketched the Bayesian framework, and then said, look, there are all these things that lie outside it, and that was when he started talking about explanation and simplicity and so forth. So I'm broadly in agreement with the comments he made there. I don't think that the Bayesian framework has the answer to all of our epistemological worries. There are lots of things on which it falls silent. For example, when you start asking Bayesians, what's the status of simplicity? They say, oh, you make your simplicity judgments and you code them into your priors. And that's not very helpful because it doesn't tell you anything about how to make your simplicity judgments. So there are lots of things that just lie outside the domain of the framework. However, it seems to do an extremely good job, while every other account we can think of does an absolutely disastrous job of making sense of the relative frequency relationship to confirmation. So for that reason, the way that I want to tackle the problem of probability in many worlds is first to go back and remind ourselves of how the Bayesian framework is supposed to work in the normal case when we're not talking about branching theories. And then with that clearly on the table, think about what we should do once we come to take a many worlds theory seriously. And the argument is going to be, when you remember your reasons for being Bayesian in the first place and you just import those reasons across to the many worlds case, you're going to see that this principle that the many worlds theorist needs is going to come out as having precisely the same status as this one. If we need to then subtly modify this one, we'll do the same to this, but we'll do that later. Okay, so on to section three. Let me do this brief review of a very simple Bayesian calculation, just so I've got it all on the table. This is going to be very familiar to many people. Suppose that you have two theories, we'll call them T1 and T2. And suppose you're about to perform an experiment that has two possible outcomes. We'll call them E. E is the piece of evidence that you're going to get in a minute. And then not E is the other possible outcome for the experiment. So in this situation, you've got two theories and two possible outcomes. You have four possible worlds. So each of these is a non-branching world, time zone up the board. This is the time now, T0. At some later time, you're going to make the observation. And you're then going to learn something about which possible world you're in. Specifically, you're going to learn either that you're in this world or this world, or you're going to learn that you're in this world and this world. This world or this world. So these are your possible bits of evidence. Okay, and what we want to know is if you start out with some particular prior credence function giving your prior degrees of belief in your theories. For example, suppose you started off having a degree of belief a half in each theory. What we want to know is what's going to happen, how are your degrees of belief going to evolve when you make your observation?
So I've never understood this argument. So where I get off the rail is right here.
Okay.
What do you mean by degree of belief that doesn't have a component of a probability?
What do you mean by a component of probability?
Well, my understanding is the claim that this is an alternative framework for thinking about probabilities rests on that it makes sense to talk about degree of belief in a way that if I define it, I will not use the notion of probabilities in defining it. That is that my degree of belief is not the probability that I think the theory is true.
Yes, it is.
Okay.
Do these CRs obey the usual rules of probability theory?
Yes.
So.
Yes, CR is a measure on the set of possible worlds.
And it's a probability measure.
Yes.
So why not call it E?
Because I take probability to be a wider term than credence. Credence is specifically about some ideal agent's degrees of belief. Huh. Probability could be anything, could be physical probability. Mm-hmm. So I want to be more specific. Was that answer?
Yeah.
That makes sense. Mm-hmm. So,
well, sort of. Some sort of lowers.
But this is not a relative frequency notion of probability.
It's definitely not a relative frequency notion of probability.
Well, it's sort of like probability, but it's applied to particular systems that have credences.
Yeah. Okay, I skipped the bit about relative frequency backing. Let me briefly go back to that. So one reason why you might be particularly bothered about probabilities in a many worlds interpretation is if you think that probability just means relative frequency. If you think that the sentence, the chance of spin up is 2/3, just means in a sufficiently long run of trials, the relative frequency of spin up will be 2/3. Then you're going to particularly hate the many worlds interpretation because, as David kept insisting yesterday, if you're a many worlds theorist and you're currently at this prior to the measurement of time, there's no such thing as the relative frequency of spin up. There are just all the different relative frequencies that you get from all the different branches. So if you thought that probability should be defined by a relative frequency in the first place, then you would think the many worlds interpretation is sunk. I'm not talking so much about relative frequency because I think the project of defining probability in terms of relative frequency is hopeless in the first place for reasons that came up earlier in discussion with Lee. So I'm just shelving that program, saying, okay, frequentism doesn't work, let's put it aside, let's look at the alternative. The best alternative seems to be Bayesianism.
But it's not the only alternative, is that right? There are a range of different interpretations of probabilities.
When you say interpretations of probability, you mean things like logical probability?
Yeah, I mean, so we've got the frequency one, which you don't like, and the credence one, which you're going to talk about now, and then there's kind of six others. Is that right?
It is right when you're talking about hashing out various ways in which the term probability is used. I'm not sure that it's right if you're talking, if you're looking for models of theory confirmation that deal with the relationship between relative frequencies and probabilities. I'm not aware of any other remotely well-developed programs for dealing with that issue.
Right. So this would better work, otherwise.
I mean, there probably are some primitive programs, but this one is very mainstream, and as far as I can see, it does a perfectly good job. So it's the one that I'm trying to develop in the many worlds context. Okay. All right, so we have four theories. We have an experiment with two possible outcomes. We start out with a prior which says I have equal degree of belief in these two theories, and I'm not contemplating any other possibilities just to make things simple. And we want these to be probabilistic theories. So each theory, T1 and T2, is going to assign some chance to the outcome E. Let's suppose, for example, that the chance of E, according to theory T1, is 2/3. And in order that this end up being an experiment that discriminates between the two theory, let's have the chance of E according to theory T2 be something different. In this example, I'm going to make that 1/12. Okay. Now we need two principles. Two principles that our rational agent has to obey in order for the Bayesian model to do what we want. The first one, in philosophical circles, goes by the appalling name of principle. This says that your credence function has to respect the chances postulated by your various theories in a certain particular way. Roughly, the idea is, look, if you believe some theory according to which the chance of heads is 3/4, your degree of belief that the outcome of the experiment is heads has better also be 3/4. If you say, I think the chance of heads is 3/4, but my degree of belief that the outcome of heads will be 1/10, then you're crazy. So the principle is supposed to be ruling out this kind of craziness. This is what it says.
So this is just saying that the conditional probability conditioned on your believing that theory one is right, if your credence should be equal to the probability assigned by that theory.
Yeah, that's what it says.
So you're assuming you're always dealing with rational agents.
Yes. I don't care if I'm a non-rational agent. I don't care what happens to the degrees of belief of non-rational agents.
Right.
Because having the degrees of belief of non-rational agents in some theory, you do sit by evidence, doesn't show that the theory has actually been rationally confirmed by the evidence. I just want to know what happens to rational agents.
This is what gets economists in trouble, isn't it? Because they have models based on rational agents and markets. That was spectacularly bad. The model's bad.
Well, they might be developing bad models, but okay, look, I'm not trying to model real people.
Right.
Except insofar as real scientists are rational.
Right. But it's hard to imagine beliefs attaching to anything other than people or something similar, sentient beings in a way. So there's a sort of dualism creeping in here by assigning credence and belief. These are very sort of mind-centered concepts.
I don't think I'm following.
Well, we're trying to develop a theory of probability which is based on the belief that will be carried by a rational agent.
Theory of confirmation.
Right. So that just seems to me to be a subtle form of dualism, because it implies...
Okay, what are the two things that I'm going to give us?
Well, you have the world and agents who observe the world and have beliefs about it.
Oh, sure, if you like.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not. I'm not committed to saying that at the end of the day these observers are outside the universe or anything.
No. You can say they're a different sort of thing. They are, again, a subset of the branch of decohering history. It's got all these decohering histories, but the entire subset of that has you know, these rational angels, Iguses, I suppose. Is that an Igus?
Let me just get to the end of sketching how the Bayesian thing is supposed to work, and tell me again if you think there's some problem there, because I'm not saying that it's going to end up being problematic.
I'm just raising all sorts of fascinating issues. Sure. Sorry to keep interrupting.
Okay, so codification of...
require Iguses to be rational, I suppose.
Well, Hillary, I think you could sidestep this by pointing out, and I think you would agree with this, that these rules are normative rules.
Right.
Any given agent, like Hillary herself, is not completely coherent in the probabilistic sense, but she strives to be. And what the theory tells you is what you should do in the best case scenario. And adopting the principle,
that's getting in deeper.
An old from an is.
But maybe just go ahead.
Let me just at least get to the end of the calculation.
That gets in deeper and deeper.
Okay, so this is just what Tom says. Your degree of belief in A, conditional on the proposition that the chance of A is X, you better be X, otherwise you're not rational. Other principle is more familiar, conditionalization. This tells you how to update your previous function when you learn something new. And this one just says, okay, if you started off with the credence function CR, and you learn some piece of evidence E, where E is some subset of your set of possible worlds, then you're going to move to some new credence function, call it CR sub E. And we'll tell you what this new credence function should be. Your new credence in any proposition whatsoever should be equal to your old credence in that proposition conditional on E. So intuitively what this says is, when you learn E, what you do is first you assign degree of belief 0 to all the possible worlds in which E does not occur, and then you redistribute your credences, but then you renormalize. You keep fixed the ratios of your credences in the E world, but you increase all the numbers so that they add up to 1 like they did before.
Chances obey the rules of probability theory?
That's right.
So they're not probabilities because...
As I'm using the term, they are probability. Probability is just this very thin notion where, to be a probability, you just have to satisfy the axioms of probability.
And chances?
Chances are special cases of that.
Chances. So shouldn't the chances be relative to the theory?
Yes, they are.
We could put a little subset E down on it.
If you think that this theory is true, then you will think that the chance of E is 2/3. If you think that this theory is true, then you will think that the chance of E is 1/12.
Yeah, okay. It goes the other way around on the principle. If the chance is 1/12, then your credence should be 12.
Your credence in a conditional proposition that the chance of A is X should be X. Your credence in A conditional on any proposition that entails this should be X. So in particular, your credence of A conditional on theory T2 should be a 12.
So you should put a subscript under CH in the...
I don't think I should.
Yeah.
But I don't think that'll make a difference. I will if you like. Well, look, so here's what I really don't want to do. I don't want to just do this.
Right.
This would be a disaster. This would say your credence in A, conditional on the proposition that the chance of A, according to theory T1 is X, should be X. That principle is false. Right. I mean, I might think that theory T1 is crazy, but I do think that according to theory T1, the chance of A is X. That's not enough. That's not enough to force me to have degree of belief X in A. That's why I'm resisting this move. I don't think that should be good.
So what's the chance of A?
I don't know. I don't know which theory is true. Could be this, could be that. That's what I'm trying to find out.
Well,
The true chance doesn't depend upon the theory. The true chance is some property of the universe. Correct?
The true chance depends on which theory is true. If you're in either of these possible worlds, then the true chance of E was 2/3. If you're in either of these possible worlds, then the true chance of E was 1/12.
But imposing the principle, you're treating the chance as just some objective feature of the world. It has nothing to do with my theory about the world. Or...
Well, it does have something to do with your theory about the world and my theory of the world, because your theory and my theory...
Is this talk of being in different worlds essential? That is, when you say, if I'm in this world, or I'm in this world, or I'm in this world, or I'm in this world, can I replace that talk with talk in which I say there's one world,
yes, and
I'm ignorant of what is true about it?
Yes. Instead of saying I'm in this world, I could have said if this world is the actual world. The real world.
Are you happy with replacing all of that talk with, well, there's one world, I live in it, but I'm ignorant about some of its properties?
Yes.
Okay, good.
Yes, so I would have, if I was talking that way, which I'm fine with, I would have said, here are a lot of possible worlds, exactly one of them is real, I don't know which.
No, what I'm trying to push you away from is the possible world's language.
Oh, okay.
Which, given that, what, you know, given...
Even if I say only one of the possible worlds is real, you still don't want me to even talk about them. Is that the idea?
Well, I want to know whether or not the use of that language is an essential part of your argument, or is just a convenient way to say things that I can say without alluding to possible worlds.
I think the latter, although I think the difference between the way I'm talking and the way you're talking is going to end up being minimal. I mean, so I could talk, I suppose, I want to have these things that I'm calling possible worlds. I want to represent something that does their job somehow, but it could just be a list of all the properties that this world is going to have. So instead of saying, if I'm in this possible world, I could have said, if the world has all of the following properties, and then listed all the properties of this possible world. And that would end up talking your way, right?
Yes.
So if I just say, okay, what I mean by possible world is that set of properties.
You would be talking my way if you said some of the properties. That is the idea that we rationalizing whatever can give an exhaustive list of the properties of the world that we're in is an assumption that I don't think I need to make to do science.
I don't think I was making it.
Well, you said,
so I can make conditional statements of the form, if the world has all of the following properties, then blah blah blah, without making any statements of the form, the world has all the following properties and giving an exhaustive
list. Okay, good.
Alright, so what I wanted to do was just plug through and see what happens if you have a Bayesian agent who starts out with this prior, and you have two theories that have these chances, and your agent obeys these two principles. And it's not very hard. So first of all, your agent has some credence function on the set of four possible worlds at time t0. Okay, so we know that the credence in these two worlds has to add up to 1/2. We also know by this principle that the ratio of credence in the E world to the not E world has to respect this chance. So this one has to be twice as big as that one. So we have, I'm going to write it like this to make later comparisons easy. So that's how the credences in these two worlds pan out. Over here we also have credences totaling 1/2, but here the ratios between the two have to respect these chances, so we're going to have this. So at time t0, these numbers give the agents degrees of belief in the four possible worlds. Then time passes, and the agents either going to learn that E is true in her world, or that not E is true. Let's suppose, for the sake of argument, she learns that E is true. Then she updates by conditionalization. Conditionalization tells her to set to 0 credences in all the worlds that she's just learned are not actual and not the ones she did. And then to renormalize elsewhere. So you're going to end up with credence 8/9 over here and credence 1/9 over there. And the point of going through this exercise is that we can now see how this principle, which I said, okay, at least something like this is right. We can now see how something like that principle emerges in the Bayesian framework. What's happened is we see that if you start out with two theories, one of which assigns higher chance than the other for some given event, and you observe that event, then the credence in the theory that assigned the higher chance gets boosted, and credence in the theory that assigned the lower chance goes down. And according to the Bayesian model, those are the conditions under which you say evidence E confirms theory T1 plus theory T2. Okay. What I'm going to do next is say what we should say about the problem of probability in many worlds, if this is what we say about confirmation of probabilistic theories aside from many worlds. So I guess if there are still compelling objections to anything like this way of thinking about theory confirmation, this would be the place to raise them. All right, so brief interlude, point number four on the handout. Sometimes when one talks about Bayesianism in a physics setting, one meets with walls of resistance, and the source of the wall of resistance is something like this. Look, you Bayesian guys are talking about degrees of belief of agents, and you think that only by talking this way can we make sense of probabilities in physical theories. But something seems to be very fishy here, because physics is about the world, not about the state of people's heads. So isn't all this talk of degrees of belief horribly subjective, and shouldn't we be able to do physics without getting into all this thorny stuff about rationality? I don't think that's right. Here's what I think is a quick way of seeing why it can't be right. You can tell the physical story without saying anything about rationality. In the case of theories like this, you could just say the chance of E according to theory T1 is 2/3, and you could forego telling any of the rest of Bayesian's story. You would then have a complete physical description of the world according to theory T1, as the straw man that I just quoted said he wanted. However, what you wouldn't be able to do is ask questions about whether or not it was rational to believe in theory T1 on the basis of evidence E. You can't ask questions about whether it's rational to believe this theory or that theory, whether it's rational to take this theory seriously on the basis of that evidence, unless you've been willing to address questions about the relationship between theories of physics and theories of rationality. To put it another way, as soon as you're asking questions about theory confirmation, you're asking questions about the relationship between physics on the one hand and rational belief on the other. And if those are the sorts of questions you're asking, it shouldn't come as a surprise that in answering the questions, you need to talk about rationality as well as talking about physics. So that's the sort of reason why I think resistance to Bayesian methods in confirmation of physical theories is misguided.
Supposing really is a theory T3, which is going to be invented at time T2 after this, which is really true.
Yeah.
Okay. If I were a relative frequentist, I would have simply commented on your experiment. You did one measurement. You have a probabilistic theory. You cannot conclude much. It looks like T1 is doing a little bit better than T2. But why don't I wait till you've done a million cases, and then we can talk about whether the statistics cluster is near 2/3 or 1/12. And I would stop there, and I would not allow myself to have the further discussion about what's more rational to believe. And one reason I wouldn't do it is that your calculation assumes that this is an exhaustive list. But it's never true that there's an exhaustive list of theories. It's always possible that it's always useful to compare different theories, but it's always likely that the more correct theory is to be invented in the future. And if it's rational for me to believe on the basis of past evidence that that I should not be adding up probabilities for different theories to be true that I have on the table now and saying those probabilities have to add up to one, then I can't do your calculation.
Okay, good. All right, there's a lot going on there. Okay, first point, of course I agree, there are always lots of theories we haven't thought of, and probably we haven't thought of a true one.
But you agree, I mean, it's very weak. The whole point about relative frequency that is taught to us as scientists is that you can't conclude much from one case about testing a probabilistic theory.
Okay, so I talked about one case here just to make the example simple. I could have made it a long-run relative frequency experiment and had these results be relative frequency results instead of single outcome results. That wouldn't have changed anything about the example except the numbers. This one would have got very close to 1, and this one would have got very close to 0.
Right, but the fact that you have a methodology that allows you to do what you do, and you believe that those numbers 8/9 and 1/9 mean something.
I think they mean something, but I don't. Okay, I think they do mean something, but I don't think they mean what you think I think they mean. So let me say a bit more about that. This is an issue of how realistically you want to take the Bayesian framework. So the hardcore realist Bayesian would say, you know, these really are the degrees of belief of agents. Real agents should strive to be like this. You really should try and have precise degrees of belief in theories. They really should add up to one. And when you do an experiment like this, you really should end up being confident with degree of belief 8/9 that theory T1 is true. That's the hardcore realist Bayesian. That's not me. I want to use this framework in a slightly different way. All that I think the framework has going for it is that if you take theory T is confirmed by evidence E to mean credence of an ideal Bayesian agent, which, by the way, isn't anything like any real agent. Credence of an ideal Bayesian agent in T1 gets boosted by conditionalizing on observation E. Then you have a Bayesian model which very nicely systematizes all the things that we take ourselves to know about confirmation until we start talking about the subtle sorts of issues you were raising earlier. So I just want to use this to model what's going on here and to get out of the paradoxes that people get into if they think that they have to talk about assumptions of typicality and so forth, which one does outside of the Bayesian.
Well, I'm very glad you haven't mentioned typicality.
Sorry?
I'm very glad you haven't mentioned typicality.
One of the reasons I like this framework is I think if you don't go this sort of route, you end up being compelled to do something like talk about typicality and or just to make sense of probabilistic reasoning, and that's a quagmire that I don't want to go into.
Okay, go on. This is where I get off the Bayesian talk right. Entirely. So
even if I'm a non-realist Bayesian, like the one I just described.
Yeah, this is
just a model that nicely systematizes things we take ourselves to know about confirmation.
No, go ahead because you're doing something interesting with it. But not everybody in the world is a Bayesian, and the reason why some of us are not are some of the issues. You can rule these issues out because you're saying if you're Bayesian, then this is how you would approach many worlds. I mean, it's interesting to hear.
I'm trying to disambiguate two senses of is a Bayesian. There's a hardcore realist Bayesian, and there's is a modeling Bayesian. I'm just a modeling Bayesian.
Well, what is a realist Bayesian?
A realist Bayesian is a guy who says.
People tell me I'm not realist all the time, and I sound like that.
No, but the card carrying Bayesian says roughly the sort of thing that you were saying earlier, right? Ideal agents really have precise degrees of belief in theories. Those degrees of belief add up to one, and you should try and be as much like that as possible, because in that way you'll become more rational. Also, they assume that, normally in order to get the Bayesian framework to run, it's a bit uncomfortable dealing with some catch-all theories we haven't yet thought of hypothesis, and then asking for the chance of evidence being conditional on the truth of this catch-all theory. You can do that, and I think if you want to be something like a hardcore realist Bayesian, that's the way to take account of the obviously true point Lee was making, namely that we haven't thought of most theories yet.
It's just a funny term. To me, it's a funny term to call that realist Bayesian.
Yeah, sure. There's not much practice in the central way.
Did we derive Born's rule yet?
Or? We're not going to derive Born's rule today, sorry.
where are we on?
We're trying to dissolve a problem which you don't think exists in the first place, namely the problem of how it can possibly make sense to talk about probabilities other than 0 and 1 in a theory according to which all of the histories are real, like many worlds theory.
So we're assuming, we can assume Born's rule for the branch weight.
You can stick a Born measure over branches, but according to this worry, you can't call it the probability that that branch will be real if you've got a theory which says that definitely all branches will be real.
And did you solve that? In some?
That's what I'm trying to do,
Okay. So we postulate the Born measure.
We've got a measure, but we don't yet know why, if at all, we should care about this measure, and that's what I'm trying to answer.
Okay.
Could I just, at that point, then raise the issue that everybody assumes that Born's rule either comes out or we add it as additional rule?
Yes.
But you could have a different rule. You could have Davis's rule. It might be a bit like Born's rule, but a bit different. Is there any fundamental reason we can't generalize quantum mechanics to...
No, there's an empirical reason. You can generalize it in that way, but if you're just picking some rule out of the sky, the theory that you come up with is going to be empirically disconfirmed by the sorts of evidence we in fact have.
But nobody's tested Born's rule, for example, at ultra high energy.
Oh, sure, yeah, you can play around with those kind of modifications.
Right, but we can't see any reason within the theory to exclude this broader class.
Well, maybe we can, maybe we can't. These are the attempted derivations of the Born law.
Right,
but
they've all failed. Right.
Well, it's arguable. David was arguing about it yesterday. So David Deutsch and David Wallace think that in the many worlds context they can derive the Born law. That is, they think they can show that if there are many worlds theorists aside from the Born rule, you're forced to adopt the Born measure for the probabilities.
So if you were to write down some simple alternative to the Born rule, you would expect that you would arrive at a mathematical contradiction or something.
Not quite as strong as that, but you'd arrive at some sort of mess under these terms, yeah.
Could we consider different Born rules as different keys, different theories,
yes.
And then proceed in that way and wind up with Born's rule in the end from the experimental statistics?
Yes, that's what I suggest we do.
Well, from the empirical aspect, so that you would...
Yeah, that's what she suggests we do.
That is what she suggests
that's her,
we do.
That's one way of bypassing the discussion of can we derive Born rule. Even if we can't, then we just do exactly what you just said, and we do the experiments, and we find out that the theory of Born's rule is the right one. Okay, all right, so now we have a Bayesian model which seems to give, at least according to me, seems to give a good account of theory confirmation in this extremely simple sense where we're just trying to get right the relationship between relative frequency evidence and confirmation of chancy theories. That account seems to do a good job in the case of chancy theories. And now the problem is that we're trying to deal with a situation where we think that maybe the world is a branching one. So we think that this diagram then no longer exhausts our space of epistemic possibilities. What we want to do now is weigh up theories like something like Copenhagen quantum mechanics, where you have non-branching universes and chances for each on the one hand, and many worlds theories where you have branching universes on the other. And the problem is, without further comment, we just have no idea how to apply the Bayesian framework in this sort of setting. In particular, when we think about it a bit further, the first thing that occurs to most people, the first natural way of generalizing the Bayesian framework to a setting that includes many world theories, yields absolute disaster. So, suppose now that theory T2 is many worlds, and we think that we can no longer call the numbers that the theory assigns to branches chances, because this is our many worlds theory, so we're going to call them something else. Let's call them branch rates. And now we want to know how belief updating goes. That is, we want to know what our agents' degrees of belief are, what our ideal Bayesian agents' degrees of belief are going to be, that she's in each of these four possible histories at the later time after she's observed the outcome of her experiment. And the first idea that occurs to most people when we ask the question of how we should generalize this rule to apply to this sort of setting is the one that I call naive conditionalization, which David also alluded to yesterday. The thought just runs like this. Look, we already know how to update degrees of belief in theories. What you've got to do is you've got to look for the likelihood of that evidence given the theory, and then you've got to plug that likelihood into the conditionalization formula. The problem with this updating strategy, as David mentioned yesterday, is that according to the many worlds theory, the probability that E will occur somewhere in the multiverse is 1. So if you just plug that naively into the conditionalization formula, you have a situation where any possible experimental outcome you care to mention is more likely on the many worlds hypothesis than it is on any arbitrarily selective non-many worlds hypothesis. That is, if you choose this updating rule, what's going to happen is no matter what you see, no matter what the outcome of your experiment, credence in the many worlds theory is going to get boosted relative to credence in any non-many worlds theory. Now, the cheap answer here would be to say, great, I was trying to define the many worlds theory and just prove that everything confirms it, so we should all believe it, let's all go ahead. But that's obviously not right, and it's obviously not something that the objective to many worlds wants to take seriously either. What this shows, what the fact that this updating rule gives you this crazy result shows, is that it's not the right updating rule. So what we have to do is throw out David's intuitions about what you have to plug into the Bayesian updating rule, namely the idea that you have to plug in these likelihoods, where the many worlds likelihoods are 1. And we have to think more carefully about how you should update when many worlds theories are among the theories that you're trying to confirm and disconfirm. So I have a proposal for this, and I have some arguments for this proposal, but I probably won't get that far. And it's extremely simple. So this is the account which I'm claiming is a just natural, straightforward generalization of the usual Bayesian strategy, and it's the account that David's claiming is not so straightforward when you look at it more closely. So you can decide for yourselves here's how it's supposed to go. Okay, so you still have your chance theory, which says the chance, according to theory T1, of outcome E is 2/3. You now have a branch of theory, which doesn't assign chances. The only chances in the theory are 1, but it does assign weights to the branches, so there's a measure on this set of branches, adding up to 1, in this case 1/12 here and 11/12 here. According to me, what we need in order to get the, in order to have a Bayesian story about what we do here, what we need is a weighty version of this principle. So we already have a principle constraining the relationship between chances and credences. Now that we're considering theories which don't postulate chances but do postulate branch weights, we need an analogue of this principle. Tell us what to do with branch weights. So this is the one I'm calling, for want of a better name, weighty principle. It has no more and no less justification than that one. What this one says, almost, but not quite, is that your credence in A, given that the branch weight of A is X, is X. All right, that's almost right, but it's not quite. The thing that's not quite right about it is that we can no longer be talking about credence functions in this updating formula. The reason is that your credences are not defined on the set of possible histories. If it's now before the measurement, you can't have a credence that you're on this branch because you know that you're either here or here or here. And if the Manuel's theory is true, it's not the case that you're on this one as opposed to this one, or vice versa. So credence function is this thing that I've written down. At the later time, but not yet, the credence function will be defined on this set of four possible histories. However, in the meantime, we can write down a measure on the set of four possible histories, which I'm going to call a quasi-credence function. Quasi-credence has a prime on it. What the quasi-credence function does is it gives you your betting quotients at the earlier time. So if at time t0 you're asked to enter into a bet which pays off if and where E occurs, and which you lose if and where E does not occur, you still have to have some strategy for evaluating such bets. And the proposal is, what you're going to do is you're going to maximize expected utility across possible histories. That is, you have to have a measure on the set of possible histories. Notwithstanding the fact that it's not actually a credence function, it's going to behave just like credence insofar as betting is concerned. So in honor of that fact, in honor of the fact that it plays the decision theoretic role of credence, I'm calling it quasi-credence and denoting it CR prime. So your quasi-credences in this case, so these are, the quasi-credences are features of the agent's head at time t0. However, they give a measure that's defined on the set of possible histories, not the set of possible worlds at time t0. And the numbers, perhaps not surprisingly, are precisely the same as the numbers for the credences were in the previous example. And then the updating rule is, this is the guy that you update using the same mathematical expression that you know and love from your previous Bayesian experience. And if you follow this policy, then of course, what happens to your credences is exactly the same as what happened before. You end up having disconfirmed your branching theory relative to your non-branching theory because the branch weight that your branching theory assigned to the observed outcome was lower than the chance that your non-branching theory assigned to that outcome. So what's supposed to come out from this is that notwithstanding the initial worries we might have had about whether or not this theory could possibly be falsifiable given that it predicts everything you can possibly think of on some branch, it turns out that it is disconfirmable. Never mind falsifiable, we're not talking about that. It is disconfirmable. Here's a situation in which it was disconfirmed.
So, excuse me. I really have to interject here because I'm not sure I see why this is not just a game of words.
Yeah.
So you have these weights which you're refusing to call probability.
Yes.
And then you're saying, well, but I'm going to tell you to bet on those weights as if they were probabilities. And then you find that you get the same results that I got as if I thought they were probabilities.
Yeah.
So why didn't I just call them probabilities and be done with it?
Because, well, I'm trying to...
Well, let me try this, right? I mean, so the idea is maybe that we found a way, or you found a way, from going from branch weights to credences, right, while still being able to maintain that the probability for everything is one.
Well, almost. So I'm from branch weights to quasi-credences. I'm trying to give my objector the words that he's obsessed about. He's obsessed about the word probability, and he's obsessed about the word credence. So he thinks that I can't talk about the probability of a future outcome if I'm a many worlds theorist, and I also can't talk about the credence that that particular outcome will occur if I'm a many worlds theorist, unless I'm saying the probability is one and my credence that it will happen is one. So I'm trying not to get bogged down in the semantic disputes. I don't want to play word games. So I'll just give him the words he wants. I'll say, okay, in this theory, the probability of everything is one and your credence in everything is one. However, those probabilities and those credences play no decision theoretic or confirmation theoretic role. The important thing, the thing that plays the confirmation theoretic and decision theoretic role, is this quasi-credence function.
So to me, that does sound like a word game, but because you're worried, you're just giving people words because they're...
Well, I mean, the alternative would be to get into a semantic dispute with my opponent, maybe David Adler, for example, about whether or not it's really right to call these things probabilities. That would be an argument about words.
No, I understand that.
See, I thought that when Pascal invented the theory of probability, the purpose was to figure out how to bet. And so, you know, probability is just a way of telling me how to bet.
Yeah, okay, so I'm quite sympathetic to this kind of argument. So you could make a stronger claim. You could say, no, David Albert, I'm not going to give you the words that you're insisting should be used in a certain way. Let's go back to the circumstances that induced us to introduce the concept of probability in the first place. They were all about betting. You see how betting works in a money world scenario. And then you see that, after all, it really is right to talk about the probability of this outcome as opposed to that one will happen. I'm quite sympathetic to that, but it's just adding an extra semantic claim to my story that isn't essential.
Well, but then these other probabilities which say that the probability for every outcome is one become totally meaningless because they're not the proper basis for making bets.
So is the only point of those probabilities to classify being proper?
The ones that are one everywhere in the world story. Yes, that's all we do. Well, you know, so the move is, look, take this word as one, it's not going to do your argument any good. That's the move I'm making today. Okay. All right, so the point of this is, in just the same way that the original Bayesian story underwrote the principle that we already thought we had, this Bayesian story underwrites this principle, and as soon as we've got this principle, the many worlds theorist is no worse off than anyone else. We have the result that ordinary sorts of relative frequency evidence confirm and disconfirm many worlds version of quantum mechanics in just the same way that they disconfirm a branching version of quantum mechanics. All right, I could either make a few more brief comments or we could just go to general questions, what you want. Okay, so point six, many worlds are no worse than one. Okay, some of you have noticed I haven't talked about derivations of the Born rule. There is this additional Everettian project of trying to argue that in the many worlds case, we can give a substantive argument for this principle. That is, we can give a substantive justification for this principle, which has always been an essential ingredient in the Bayesian framework. In contrast, continues the claim, no non-many worlds theorist has ever been able to give us a justification for this principle. So if you're a Copenhagen quantum theorist, for example, if you buy anything like the Bayesian framework, if you buy anything like the innocuous claim that these chances are things that you should pay attention to when you're deciding which bet's better than which other bets, I think pretty much everyone accepts that. The non-many worlds theorist has never had any particular argument for that claim. That is, what would be irrational if you're a Copenhagen or a spontaneous collapse type of quantum theorist about saying, okay, I think that the chance of heads coming up six in a row is 1/50. Nevertheless, I'm going to bet at even odds that heads will come up six times in a row. What's wrong with that? The thought is, not much we can say in the non-many worlds case. This is just a primitive postulate of rationality. Primitive postulates of rationality are very fishy sorts of things. We normally want to justify them. the non-many walls theorists can do much better. So this is the argument that David was talking about a little bit yesterday. It's due originally to David Deutsch and has been developed a lot, especially in the rationality theory context, by David Wallace. My take on this is, I'm not sure whether those arguments go through or not, but if the only claim that you're trying to make is that the many worlds theorist doesn't have a problem with probability that other people don't have, and that is the only claim I'm trying to make, it doesn't matter. We don't have to get into this discussion of whether or not the many worlds theorist can derive the Born rule. We can just do what Jim was suggesting earlier. That is, okay, say that this doesn't follow. Say that no particular branch weight measure follows from the rest of many worlds quantum theory. Start off with a whole load of many worlds quantum theories postulating different measures, and then go out and test them. What you'll find is the one that uses the Born rule measure, is empirically confirmed at the expense of the others. So at the end of the day, you're going to end up with the Born rule anyway, whether or not you thought you could derive it.
Subject to error bars as what?
That's all right, sure. How did I work this thing? I was going to talk about David Albert's objections, since he was kind enough to supply me with a text of this book. Does anyone know how it works?
Transparency.
I'm a Stone Age speaker.
Out point.
Sorry?
Out point.
Okay, so David yesterday did a very nice job of stating very clearly a number of worries that you might have with the sort of program that I've been sketching. So what I wanted to do was pick out what I take to be the key passages from his talk. This is from a transcript that he sent me a couple of days ago. And then say why I think this isn't quite right. Okay, so David has a little sketch of the program that I've just sketched in more detail. And then his first objection is, look, even if you grant the truth of everything that Greaves has just said, it's not going to do the many world theorists any good. And here's why specifically he takes that to be the case. He has a worry about my program. The worry is that the question at which this entire program is aimed, the question out of which this entire program arises, seems like the wrong question. The questions to which this program is addressed are questions of what we would do if we believe that the fission hypothesis were correct. But the question at issue here is precisely whether to believe that the fission hypothesis is correct. And what needs to be looked into in order to answer that question has nothing whatever to do with how we would act if we believed that the answer to that question were yes. What needs to be looked into is the empirical adequacy of that hypothesis. What needs to be looked into is whether or not the truth of that hypothesis is explanatory of our empirical experience. And the fission hypothesis, since it's committed to the claim that all such experiments have all possible outcomes with all possible frequencies, is structurally incapable of explaining anything like particular relative frequencies. So the decision theoretic program seems to act as if primarily, and in the first instance, what stands in need of being explained about the world is why we bet the way we do, but this is crazy. Okay. I think there are a lot of things going on in this. Some sentences I think are true, others I think are false, and some I think are true but misleading. So let's see if I can put this in the right place.
So he hasn't scored very highly.
Well, I picked out the bits that I thought were particularly objectionable. All right, so what do I think about this? Okay, he has a worry that my program is aimed at the wrong sort of question. Fair enough, let's hear what the worry is. He asserts that the questions which it's addressed are questions of what we would do if we believed that the fission hypothesis were correct. Okay, that's not right. I think where this objection comes from is when we have... There's a board... Board that's obscured is relevant. When you have these situations where you're not sure whether or not the many worlds theory is true and you want to know how you should accept or reject bets, typically what you do in the first instance to move to a simpler problem and try and get your head around the situation is idealize first to the case of an agent who is sure that the money walls theory is true. So she's just trying to deal with situations like, okay, I'm sure that there's going to be a branching event into a spin-up branch and a spin-down branch. And I'm being offered a choice between, say, a bet that gives me $100 on the spin-up branch and sends me to the Guantanamo Bay on the spin-down branch on the one hand, or a different bet which gives me $100 on the spin-up branch and $1 million on the spin-down branch. And I'm trying to think, okay, which of these bets is better? The point is, the way the discussion goes is that we usually first idealize this sort of case in order to establish that the rational thing to do when you're presented with bets in a branching context is to maximize expected utility across by in the sense of averaging across branches, thus in particular prefer this one to this one. Having done that, we then go back to the general case, which is the case I was sketching earlier, where you have an agent like us who isn't sure whether or not the many worlds theory is true. And you embed conclusions that you derive from a simpler context into the more general context. So it's not that this program is only considering agents who are sure that the many worlds theory is true. It's just that along the way, and for auto-pedagogical purposes, it's useful to consider such agents at some point. So that's why I think the first bit's false. Then I agree that the question that we're interested in is whether to believe the Fishing hypothesis is correct. That's why in the Bayesian context, we were considering an agent who started out with non-zero degree of belief in many worlds, non-zero degree of belief in not many worlds, and looked at what happened to the evolution of her credences between those two sorts of theories. Okay, then David asserts what needs to be looked into in order to answer that question has nothing whatever to do with how we would act if we believe that the answer to the question were yes. This is false, and it's important that it's false, and it's false for quite a deep reason. What David's asserting there is essentially that decision theory and confirmation theory are altogether separate. That's not right. When you look at the arguments that we have for the principle of conditionalization, this one, by the way, does have arguments. It's not just one of these unsatisfactory primitive rationality postulates. All of the arguments proceed by tying later credences to earlier betting quotients. For example, the most well-known argument in favor of conditionalization is a Dutch book argument. You can show that if you update your degrees of belief by any recipe other than conditionalization, we can make a Dutch book against you. That is, we can find some set of bets, some of which we offer you at the earlier time before the measurement result is observed, and some of which we offer you at the later time. And each of the bets in this set has the feature that you count it as fair at the time that it's offered. But the key thing is, if you accept all of the bets in this set, then you're guaranteed a net loss, no matter what happens, no matter which possible world you're in. So that's supposed to show that updating other than by conditionalization is irrational. And the logic of it involves tying later credences to earlier betting quotients. So this separation between decision theory and confirmation theory that's underlying this second comment here just isn't there. You can't separate the two that much. All right, next, what needs to be looked into is the adequacy of the hypothesis, sure. And then he says what needs to be looked into is whether or not the truth of that hypothesis is explanatory of our empirical experience. Okay, I think that's true, but I think it's possibly misleading. What's going on here is there's a conflict of methodologies between those of us like me who think that first you figure out how confirmation goes via Bayesian modelling or otherwise. First you look at how degrees of belief evolve. And then afterwards you make inferences from that about what should count as explanatory of what. That's the program that I'm following. So I do end up concluding that many worlds theories explain Bourne-Rule relative frequencies. David, on the other hand, wants to start with intuitions about what explains what, and then build a confirmation theory that does justice to those intuitions about explanation. The reason that I think that second program is a disaster is that intuitions about explanation, especially in the probabilistic context, they're all over the place, right? You can ask questions like, suppose I have a theory which says, it's a theory of coin tosses, it assigns some chance to heads. So you work out all possible relative frequencies, and then you do you perform your long run of coin tosses. And now you ask questions like, did my probabilistic theory explain the particular outcome of coin tosses that I obtained? And you might worry that the answer is no, because look, any particular sequence of outcomes of coin tosses is extraordinarily unlikely according to your probabilistic theory. So that maybe that doesn't look very explanatory. But then on the other hand, look, my theory did tell a completely comprehensive story about what was going on, what was the mechanism underlying the coin toss, and it was a mechanism that rendered the particular outcome of coin tosses that I've observed possible, so maybe that does count as explanatory. And this just strikes me as a mess. So for this sort of reason, I think starting with intuitions about explanation is not the fruitful way forward. You should first work out the confirmation theory, and then you should infer that, in fact, the many worlds theory does explain Born-Wolf frequencies. So obviously, I think this is false. And it certainly wasn't, in that sense of explanation, it was certainly never part of the program that the explanandum, the thing that was being explained, is why real people in the world bet the way they do. I agree that would be crazy, but that's not what I'm doing. Maybe I'll stop there.
Any more questions for Hillary?
I actually have one more question. Not really about what you said and what you've argued in the objections, but some phrases that you've used for this discussion about the many worlds interpretation preserving the unitary evolution of quantum mechanics, and then you refer without details to the Copenhagen interpretation, and I'm not sure what to take that to mean.
Okay, so
but let me take the version of the Copenhagen interpretation that Jim and Gelman and Zurek and so on and so forth seem to advocate. I believe that interpretation completely preserves the unitary evolution of the wave function.
Right.
And all that's being put in is some a priori notion of probability at the beginning. And that it seemed to me that the many worlds interpretation was somehow trying to avoid making that a priori statement about probability. And now your version of it seems to me to have put it in, even though you won't necessarily use the same words.
Mm.
So at this point, I don't see what the difference is between the many worlds interpretation and what I think Jim would say is not a many worlds interpretation. Am I misquoting you?
No, not exactly, right? So, but you know, I think, isn't our answer going to be that they want to maintain this realist position, and they can't have a notion of probability, and it's realist, so they have to have a measure instead, and then the measure turns out to act, right, as far as betting goes, in exactly the same way as probabilities were, but they still can maintain the view that all the other worlds are equally real and occur with probability one.
Well, what does that mean if I'm not willing to make a bet that they hold?
Well, you don't get the check, do you, because you're on one of them.
Can I give a different answer to your question?
Sure.
Okay, so
yeah,
I take it that
we shouldn't have two different responses.
Well, I take it that the consistent histories formalism is, in a certain rather thin sense, interpretation neutral, by which I mean the following. You can try to build two very, very different sorts of realist theory of quantum mechanics on the basis of the consistent histories formalism. You can try and do what the many worlds theorist does, which is to say all of the histories are physically realized, and then you can worry about what you mean by probability on the one hand. Or on the other hand, you can say, no, here's what we're doing. We're using the consistent histories formalism as a tool for coming up with a stochastic collapse theory. That is, we're saying that exactly one of the histories in some preferred decoherent history set is real. As for Copenhagen, all I meant was the sort of shut up and calculate textbook interpretation, but I think that's closer to the second consistent history thing I said, the spontaneous collapse type theory, where you really think that there is wave function collapse. And if that's the sort of program that you're following, then you don't have unitary evolution as far as the real physical stuff is concerned. You start off considering some space of possible worlds, and the wave function describes the state of that space of possible worlds, and that thing evolves unitarily. But if you want to know what's going on in the real world, it's something that doesn't evolve unitarily. It evolves approximately unitarily for a while, and then it collapses.
But this is the same as any probabilistic theory, right? The theory of the weather that said Hurricane Katrina was going to hit Galveston. When we found out that one was wrong, we threw out that part of the probability distribution and renormalized the rest of it to
put in the fact that we knew it hit New Orleans. And I don't see the difference between that and what you're calling collapse of the wave function.
I don't see the connection between what you just said, namely you update on new information that you get, and the issue of Copenhagen.
I don't understand what collapse of the wave function means once you have given me the facts of decoherence.
Okay, so the realist sense of collapse of the wave function would say, after I make a measurement, the wave function really does collapse, by which I mean not only I can work with the collapsed component of the wave function for practical purposes when making future predictions, but also there is no element of reality still existing corresponding to the other thing that the wave function might have collapsed to. That last thing I said is denied by the many worlds theorists, but accepted by the Copenhagen-like guy.
So how do you bet on that?
No, I wouldn't, well, at least I wouldn't, in my understanding of the Gell-Mann particle proposal, I wouldn't say that that's accepted by the Copenhagen guy. They say you could keep that extra piece of the wave function around all the time, but it's not, given the conditional probability that I observed spin up at some particular time, that other piece of the wave function is never, ever, where ever means a finite time, but a finite time that's so long that it's longer than the age of the universe measured either in ages of the universe or in Planck time.
Okay.
The fact that we throw it away is just a question of practicality in the same way as it is in Weatherford.
Okay, I probably shouldn't have mentioned Copenhagen because the Copenhagen interpretation is hopelessly obscure anyway. Here's a distinction I want to insist on.
I agree with that.
I'm a scientific realist. I think there's a fact of the matter about the way the world is. And I think there's a difference between a theory which says the state of the entire physical world, the bits that I don't observe, as well as the bits that I do observe, is described by a wave function that evolves unitarily at all times, on the one hand, and a different theory which says the state of the world at any given time is given by a wave function, but it evolves non-unitarily, that is, now and then it collapses. If you're a realist, as I am, that's a genuine distinction, even though it's a distinction without easy-to-find practical implications.
Any more questions?
So I should say, in the beginning that Hillary actually agreed to give this talk at the last minute, so we're very grateful. Yes. Very interesting. Thank you very much.